The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Alongside that, you get a £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to the Edition podcast from The Spectator, where each week we shed a little light on the thought process behind putting the world's oldest weekly magazine to bed. I'm Gus Carter, The Spectator's deputy features editor.
And I'm Lara Prendergast, The Spectator's executive editor. On this week's podcast, we'll be looking at why the rich are fleeing Britain. Michael Gove interviews the Justice Secretary Shabana Mahmood, and we look into the battle over Hampstead Ladies' Pond.
The rich are taking their money and leaving the country, according to Michael Simmons in this week's cover piece. He writes that Keir Starmer is worried about who's coming into the country and this week launched a white paper aimed at cutting immigration. But actually, he should be focusing on who's in the departures lounge as well. Michael joined us alongside James Quambi, a private wealth specialist at Stevenson Harwood. And I started by asking Michael to take us through his investigation and the reasons why millionaires are leaving Britain.
Rich people, and you know, by rich people, we're talking about the uber wealthy, so billionaires, but also sort of anyone with wealth, $1 million or more, have been leaving sort of the country for about a decade now, as the UK sort of becomes a less attractive place to sort of invest, do business and live. But what's really accelerated in the last year is people leaving because they can't stand how they're being treated for tax purposes. So, as you know, listeners will know, last year in the spring budget, Jeremy Hunt abolished essentially the non-dom regime. So, you know, this idea, if listeners are not aware, that if you are non-domiciled in for the UK, you know, your earnings and your assets that are in your sort of global portfolio or in other countries, you know, are not touched by the UK tax man. And I'm sure James will go into this a bit later on, but Rachel Reeves made that change even worse. And so that's really what's prompted people to leave.
James, you are one of the country's top non-dom lawyers. What have your clients been saying to you, and are they leaving?
I probably can't repeat most of what they're saying to you because they're hopping mad. I think, you know, non-doms are humans. They have human emotions. They're not just money-making machines. And if they feel that they're not wanted in a country because of the messaging coming from the government, they won't like it and they'll consider leaving. If that's backed up with harsh measures which tax them on wealth that they have made before they came to the UK, then they're going to go. The response of my wealthiest non-doms has been to essentially just book a ticket and go somewhere else. And there are a host of places competing for this kind of global talent. So it's been a depressing tide of non-doms leaving the UK. That's what I've seen so far.
And you've described the inheritance tax change as the real villain. Could you elaborate on why that stands out compared to, say, income or capital gains tax?
So you've got to understand that most non-doms come from countries that don't have wealth taxes or death taxes. And I count death tax as a wealth tax because it's a tax on static capital. I think most people can get their heads around paying tax on a profit. So if you sell an asset at a gain, you know, be that a house or a business, you've made a profit, and handing some of that profit over to the state seems reasonable, provided the rate isn't too high. The same can be said for income profits. Handing something over to the state when you've made a profit, at least you're still in profit. The problem with wealth taxes in general and death taxes specifically is they're a tax on the whole of the capital. So if you've got someone who comes from a country that doesn't have death tax, I can mention a few big ones like India and China, but also you can chuck in basically the whole of the Middle East. They're just not used to the idea of a death tax. And I have to explain to them, if you come to this country and you stay, all of the assets that you own on your death will be taxed at 40%. It's a very, very big number. And they won't believe it because they'll say, well, what about all these assets I earned before I came here? And say, well, they'll be taxed as well. It's a real game changer. And for that reason, every government in the past has left it alone because it will cost the government more money than it raises. So that's the problem with inheritance tax.
Michael, one of the most shocking things, I think, in your cover piece is when you go through why it is we should care. Because, I mean, I think normal people listening to this might sit here and think, well, you know, what do I care if multimillionaires leave this country? But actually, you give us very good reasons for why we should.
Yeah, so the tax take in this country is already actually very sort of top heavy. So we reveal some stats in the piece that it's already public that the top 1% of taxpayers account for about, in terms of top 1% of earners, account for about a third of the income tax take. But the numbers we reveal that HMRC don't publish and we've obtained through Freedom of Information, when you zoom in to the top 0.01%, you're still talking of a huge amount of the tax take, and this is very few people accounting for about 4 million each a year. And Labour and some other sort of sceptical people say that, oh, well, some of the data on this is, you know, is a bit flaky, is a bit dodgy. But because we're so reliant on these taxpayers, even if a couple of anecdotal examples of people's clients leaving, of people announcing they're leaving, even if those cases are true, it starts to make a big dent in the Treasury's coffers. And in, you know, other stories we've done for The Spectator, it's well known, you know, how precarious the public finances are. So with these people leaving, although you might not be sympathetic, it does matter for everyone in Britain because the rest of us are going to have to pick up the bill.
I think one of the stats you pointed out is that if one of these 0.01% of the top leaves, it's going to take something like 1,300 average taxpayers to replace them. I mean, it really is quite extraordinary. James, is this something that the people you work with are kind of aware of? Do they feel a kind of sense of their importance?
In many ways, yes. But I don't think specifically on that point. I don't think a lot of taxpayers look at the macro view. They look at their own household position. But just to pick up what Michael said about the tax take, the numbers he's got in his excellent article is absolutely right. But if we look at the last time that we had truly ideological tax policy, which is mid-1970s, where we had Labour in power with a 98% rate, top rate of tax, which is almost unbelievable, right? I mean, it sounds like I've made it up. The top 1% of taxpayers in the UK were responsible for 11% of all income tax paid. So I think that really demonstrates the point Michael's made in the article that you can't just put your foot on the throat of rich people and expect that to yield the results that you want. That's ideological tax. What we need is objectively good tax policy. And what's happened is, as the top rate of income tax has come down, the tax rate from the top 1% has gone up. It seems counterintuitive. And a lot of people who read the press and so on don't actually understand that. They think just yanking up tax rates. And I think when you take that principle to non-doms, it works exactly the same way, that if you squeeze them too much, they go. And the thing about wealthy people, particularly non-doms, is they're not from the UK. So by definition, they're used to living in other countries. So if you make it too uncomfortable here in the UK, they go back to where they come from, or they find somewhere else which is more comfortable. And you end up with a counterproductive tax system. And to pick up on the point Michael made about the top 0.01, if we look at just average non-doms, there's 70,000 of them in the UK. The average non-dom brings in 15 times as much income tax as the average Brit.
James, which places are more comfortable for non-doms right now?
Well, the article references the chap who owns Aston Villa. Forgive me for forgetting his name. But he's moved to Abu Dhabi, where there is zero income tax, zero wealth tax, zero capital gains tax. Much can be said about the rest of the Middle East. I think Abu Dhabi and Dubai are very popular. Quite a few people have gone to Italy. The surprising one to me, actually, is Greece. I mean, not that they're going. It's just that if you told me a decade ago that someone would plan to move to Greece for tax purposes, I think they were clinically insane, because they used to have sort of quasi-communist governments, but they actually copied and pasted the Greek non-dom regime, whereas if you pay 100,000 euros, you're not taxed on your foreign income or profits. Now, it used to be 100,000 in Italy, by the way, but it was yanked up to 200,000 when the new government came in. So I think it's going to be Middle East. It's going to be Asia. Singapore's very popular, and Hong Kong. And then you've got the various hotspots in Europe, including Malta and Cyprus, and then you've got Caribbean. So that's where people are going.
And Michael, just finally, I think one of the most shocking things, one of the most kind of shocking points that you made, is when you speak to these people and ask them, you know, what if we just undo all of these tax changes? Will you come back? The answer is a resounding no.
Yeah. And this is actually what scared me the most. You know, when I was speaking to James for the piece, but also other people in the wealth industry, I thought, you know, let's say you look at the polls just now, let's say Reform come in and the tax take is in a dire state, and they say, right, let's make a bunch of tax breaks to attract wealth creators back. And yeah, as you say, people just say no, because more important to investors, to business owners, than it being a desirable tax situation for them is tax certainty. Because they want to make life decisions and business decisions and decisions about their finances over a sort of 10, 20-year window. And Britain now, to anyone, looks like a country that every time there's a budget, sometimes, you know, when we have two budgets in a year, that the tax position is changing all the time. You just cannot plan. So actually, in a way, the worst thing that could happen is a U-turn, because people would say, well, you just look like you're flip-flopping even more.
James and Michael, thank you for joining.
Laura, what else did you enjoy in the magazine this week?
I'm going to go for Susanna Jowett's piece about death flowers at the Chelsea Flower Show. She says that for the first time in over 100 years, the annual flower show will include funeral flowers in the Grand Pavilion. She speaks to various florists who are trying to change our attitude to funeral flowers and to try and kind of encourage a more joyful approach to the process of planning a funeral. So I enjoyed that. What about you, Gus?
I particularly enjoyed Max Jeffrey's piece, which was a reported feature where he went to Plaistow, where essentially three different babies have been found abandoned, and the police are trying to get to the bottom of the story. I think the bit that really struck me was the police said that, you know, they always work on a thesis. You know, they're always trying to find evidence that will kind of fit the theory they have, but that their thesis has recently changed for these abandoned babies, and that they've gone from thinking that the mother doesn't want the children to thinking perhaps the mother can't keep the children, that maybe she herself is being held hostage. And I think we'll hear a clip of Max now.
Elsa had been alive less than an hour, and her umbilical cord was still attached when she was wrapped in a towel, put in a Boots shopping bag, and left on the Greenway, a cycle path built on a Victorian sewage pipe that runs through East London. She was abandoned on the 18th of January 2024 by a rose shrub on the coldest night of the year. She was not the first baby to be abandoned in that area of the Greenway near Plaistow. On the 17th of September 2017, a baby boy was discovered wrapped in a towel under a bush about a mile and a half from where Elsa was later found. The hospital called him Harry. Then, on the 31st of January 2019, someone found a newborn girl, also wrapped in a towel and inside a shopping bag. She was beside a park bench 500 yards from where Elsa would be left. It was cold that night too, and the woman who found her said frost had formed on her head. She was taken to hospital, where the staff named her Roman. All three babies are black, and DNA tests showed that Elsa, Roman and Harry have the same parents. Last June, at the East London Family Court, Judge Carol Atkinson let the DNA findings be reported for the first time. While Roman and Harry have been adopted, Elsa cannot be until the police investigation to find her parents is concluded. Judge Atkinson has been pushing officers hard to track them down. In March, The Spectator contacted Detective Inspector Jamie Hum from the Metropolitan Police, who leads the investigation. Hum has worked in the Met for 19 years, three of them focusing on child investigations. He told me there was no CCTV footage of Elsa's abandonment, nor any witnesses. Detectives always work from hypotheses, and for a while Hum's was that Elsa's mum didn't want to be found. The evidence just pointed that way. Elsa and the other babies were left swaddled in public places, which seemed to indicate that whoever abandoned the children cared for them. The fact that they were found near to each other suggested the mother lived locally. But this theory changed earlier this year. In January, Crime Stoppers offered a £20,000 reward for information leading to the identification of the baby's parents. Police also appealed for help from doctors and pharmacists who may have seen the pregnant mother. Crime Stoppers got nothing. The police received only 4 calls. Instead of having a leading hypothesis that Mum will not come forward, Hum told his officers in a briefing afterwards, "My hypothesis now is that Mum, he always calls her Mum, cannot come forward. It is possible that she is being held captive in the area." Acting on this new hypothesis, police launched a manhunt last month after the National Crime Agency, or NCA, drew a GAI, or Geographical Area of Interest, looking at all the Greenway's possible entry and exit points and marking a group of 400 homes where they thought whoever left the babies probably lived. The main road in the GAI was Lonsdale Avenue, a 2-minute walk from where Elsa was found. "The answers are here," Hum Superior Detective Superintendent Lewis Basford told me.
Next up, what does Shabana Mahmood have in common with Benazir Bhutto and Margaret Thatcher? Well, in the magazine this week, she tells our editor Michael Gove that the former prime ministers of Pakistan and the UK are her heroines. But what else makes the Justice Secretary tick? She tells Michael that there is a moment of reckoning to come in a wide-ranging interview touching on grooming gangs, artificial intelligence, and the oath that she swore on the Quran. The interview was recorded for Spectator TV, as well as written up in the magazine. So rather than tell you more about it, you can now listen to a clip from it. And if you'd like to watch the full interview, go to youtube.com/SpectatorTV.
I don't want any future Lord Chancellors to be in the position of having to stare at graphs looking at zero capacity in a few weeks or months' time ever again. I think it's a terrible indictment of where we've got to as a country that's what's happening. And I can't bear that. I can't bear that as a country that's the position that we are in. It drives short-term decision-making. That's not what I'm about. We've got to fix the crisis. But it's a dual approach. So there's sorting out the permanent crisis, and then there's sorting out the slightly more hidden crisis on reoffending as well. So to my mind, the two things go hand in hand. We've got a poor track record on reducing reoffending, so we keep needing lots of prison blazes for the people that are going in and out of the system. And then the system's running out anyway. So on both these fronts, we've had an absolute shocker as a country over the last couple of decades or so. And I've got to fix it.
Doing the right thing might well mean taking political pain. Mm-hmm. Are you confident that the Prime Minister will back you in what needs to be done? And are you also prepared to see your popularity in the country potentially take a hit in order to resolve this problem? Because it may blight your otherwise bright political future.
Well, that bit is easy because it's not about me. I've got a job to do, and that's the only thing I'm focused on is what I care about. And I take a solemn oath on my holy book. And to be honest, that is a very good leveller of helping you decide what is and what is not important. And I know what's important, and getting this right for the country is the most important thing. And as for support across government, you know, the Prime Minister has backed the decisions I've been making. He's understood the scale of the crisis. He's a former Director of Public Prosecutions. He understands the criminal justice system. I think even he was shocked when I had to show him graphs during the summer of disorder last year of where the prison capacity really was at. And it was a real eye-opening moment for him and everybody else, I think, in government. But I think it is now understood across government with my colleagues in cabinet that this system is running at boiling hot and is permanently on the verge of collapse. It means it's a hard road ahead, and I accept that. But in my world, it's much worse to be putting the public at risk because you've got a permanent crisis.
Your acting permanent secretary, Amy Rees, is someone who was an outstanding prison governor. Are there in the prison state at the moment governors who you would point to as exemplars when it comes to rehabilitation? And are there some people in the system as governors who perhaps need to be moved on?
Oh, well, I won't name and shame, but there are definitely some prisons where there has been an exceptional turnaround with excellent leadership right from the top, either on, you know, running a better regime in prison, on staff safety, and then on delivering, rehabilitation programs and making a success of it. And there are other prisons that obviously struggle and where that isn't working as well as it should. My own approach is sort of not to go in on the attack, as it were, on the governors themselves. Mostly people are trying to act and do their best. It's more to think about some of the root causes, you know, that might be afflicting particular prisons on design or maintenance that are, keeping drones out, for example, to be a bigger challenge in some places than others. So sometimes there are practical things that we can look to instead. But absolutely, leadership and local leadership makes a difference, and how to take the best of that leadership and clone it or reproduce it everywhere is part of the task here as well, which I'm very alive to. I know you and others have talked a lot in your tenure about more governor autonomy and allowing governors to act more freely over the prison that they run. It's not something I'm ideologically opposed to in any way. I just think I've come in at the point where, you know, there is the crisis of capacity, yep, first and foremost. And my first job is to get the capacity problem sorted before I can sit with my governors and work out actually what kind of leadership it takes to run the better prison.
So don't make the perfect the enemy of the good.
Exactly.
Solve the crisis now and then see what more can be done.
Absolutely. But I fully accept that once you're beyond the capacity crisis, there is a big job to do to make sure our prisons are effective.
Prisons aren't the only crisis area you face. We have a huge court backlog.
We do.
And justice delayed is justice denied. Do you believe that there needs to be a change in the way in which our courts are run, and also a change in the way in which we approach what a fair trial means? The Times' Crime and Justice Commission has suggested that we should have fewer jury trials in order to accelerate justice. And this is a call that's been backed by former Lord Chancellors. What's your view?
We need big reform in our courts. I think that it's become a little bit too easy to say justice delayed is justice denied, but with no action then to stop justice from being delayed. I think that, again, one of the horror discoveries when I came into office was even running the system with funding at total max system capacity, the backlog still goes up. And that's because the sheer demand coming into the system is huge. That is a good thing because it means people are, you know, taking complaints to the police, they're being investigated, charges are being brought, cases are coming to court. But the system is overwhelmed. It's never really recovered from the pandemic, although the backlog was rising before then as well, but it was all made much worse in the pandemic. So nothing short of once in a generation reform to how our courts work, I think, will do the job here. And again, you know, it sort of falls to me to be the person to say, okay, if we really believe as a society justice delayed is justice denied, then we're going to have to change the way trials run in our courts. And that's why I've asked Brian Leveson to think about that once in a generation reform. He will also report in the next month or so. You know, I won't be giving away any trade secrets if I say the sort of territory you're looking at is a restriction of the sorts of cases that get a Crown Court full jury trial, maybe make more use of the Magistrates Court, but also, as the Times Justice Commission and others have looked at, the possibility of an intermediate court between the magistrates and the Crown Court that can hear more cases, which might be judge-only or judge-led in some way. There'll be different models, I'm sure, suggested to us. That is controversial because it means some cases that currently get heard in front of a jury won't in future. But, you know, I think we have to reinterrogate what justice really means. And if you're a victim today of, say, rape and you're waiting 4 years to get to court, that's no kind of justice at all in my book. So we have to do something differently here.
Everyone understands the pressure on our courts. Some might say this is an erosion of a traditional liberty, and it's handing power to the experts, judges and magistrates, and taking it away from the people, jurors. What would you say to that?
Well, look, the vast majority of cases that run through our court system are not heard by juries. And that's true also for criminal cases. And 90% of the criminal cases caseload goes through the magistrates' court at the moment. So I think we have a sort of traditional view of what the jury trial looks like that doesn't really meet with the reality of where we are, of where we are today. So it's already quite restricted. 90% of the work goes through the mags. I don't think it's somehow wrong or challenging one of our foundational sort of principles that we like to think of as the jury trial, to think about restricting it for the most serious and think about how you dispose of the others. We do that anyway. So it will be an extension of current practice, which has been the case for many decades, rather than some bold new innovation that's never been thought of before or that is outwith our legal tradition. Even though in Crown Court trials, of course, the jury decides, the judge presides, but it is the judge that does sentencing. So the judge, the expert in this case, obviously has their big role to play here from having seen the whole of a trial play out. I'll just reflect that actually, soon after I was appointed Shadow Justice Secretary, just by quirk of fate, I was called up to do jury service, which was a real education in Birmingham, which I did in that summer recess. And I sat in on a trial. And on one level, it was an absolute sort of almost heartwarming bit of sort of Britishness in practice, because every single member of that jury took it so seriously. We were all from different walks of life, different levels of education. People really cared about applying the law correctly. We went back to the judge twice to ask for further information. Everyone took it properly seriously. So in that way, it's a sort of moment of pride, I guess, that we are in a country that, can rise to the occasion in this way. But the case we were looking at had been waiting 4 years to get to trial. I won't give away too many of its details, but it involved a sexual assault. The victim was 4 years older. The defendant was 4 years older, had had more family in the interim. I mean, there's no way in which you could say that system had done right by either of those people, really. And I came away from that experience thinking, my God, we've got to be able to do better, because, it's just not the right way to run these sorts of cases. So I have a high appetite, I think, for reform in this space because of what's necessary, but because I've seen firsthand through my own experiences and also in my own constituency, just the weight that victims have. And one of my colleagues lobbied me the other day on a case. I can't intervene because listings are a judicial function anyway, but they were just distraught because one of their constituents is a victim of a rape, is in her late 70s, has had the trial delayed, and thinks she might die before it actually gets before a court. I don't believe that we should be presiding over a system that has those results.
And finally, why should women have to swim with men? That's the question Zoe Strimple raises in the magazine this week as she looks at the battle for Hampstead Ladies Pond. A schism has emerged between what she labels pond turfs, who are protesting trans women being allowed to swim in the ladies' ponds, and younger right-on women who approve of the move. As she says, far from settling the issue, the recent Supreme Court ruling has actually intensified division. Zoe joined the podcast alongside Julie Bindle, and I started by asking Zoe to tell us about a recent protest that took place at the ponds.
The protest that took place on May Day was a number of ladies, as we like to call them, dressing as men in inflatable sort of man outfits. I think I saw one or two of them with that, donning mustaches, wigs, and so on, and sort of storming, we could say, the men's pond, saying, using basically the concept of self-ID, saying, we're men, so we should be able to swim here. And this is something that a lot of the ladies wonder about. Why is the debate 100% focused on men trying to get into the ladies' pond? And there's literally never anything about what that would imply for women being able to self-ID to get into the men's pond. So this isn't actually the first time that women have done something like that. And it's the other time it happened, police also came. And that incongruity right there tells you a lot about the entire situation. And the police duly came. The ladies waved excellent placards saying things like, no peens in our pond. I think at the previous protest, they'd said things like, or maybe it was at this one, let the lads jump in or something, you know, and we're self-IDing as men, so why can't we, you know, and it's a really good point. So they did jump in, and that's against a context of much more, you know, well, there have been protests outside the ladies' pond as well in 2024 last year. And I think there were rumors of more taking place outside the ladies, which are, again, you know, in response to the Supreme Court hearing now. But actually, this isn't new. Trans women are apparently have been kind of informally using the ladies' pond for, you know, a really long time. That's not how it feels. It feels like a new threat. And so since the 2019 guidance by the Ladies Pond, which is run by the City of London, that, you know, trans women are women and they should be welcomed in, you know, the atmosphere has soured somewhat because there's obviously sharp disagreement here. And yeah, it has kind of changed the atmosphere because, as one of the people I interviewed said, you have to constantly be on your lookout lest a peen appears in your pond. And actually, sometimes you do see people who are clearly not women, and it's incredibly freaky and unpleasant.
Julie, one of the things that people listening to this might struggle to understand is what that Supreme Court ruling earlier this year means. Does it say that now men that identify as women cannot enter these spaces, or does it merely say that if an organization wishes to police it on the basis of sex, they can do?
Well, first of all, it's not a ruling. It was a decision that clarified the law as has already existed for the past 15 years since the 2010 Equality Act. So it confirmed that what we should do is abide by the law of the land as opposed to the law laid down by Stonewall and other trans activist organisations, which have been very successful in convincing major institutions, including some of our police forces, Crown Prosecution Service, huge institutions such as universities, that in fact, if a man who identifies as a woman and has a certificate saying he's legally a woman, in other words, a gender recognition certificate, he is allowed to enter any female-only space. Well, that's not the case. So to answer your question, it's about the right to have women-only spaces, services, provision as and when appropriate, as decided either at the Ladies' Pond, which is making its own rules and regulations like any private members' club, or if, for example, I, as a lesbian, wish to organise an event for lesbians who, by the way, are women, shall we go back to the old-fashioned version, the ones without penises, then previous to this clarification of the law, the person that runs the venue may well have told me that I wasn't legally allowed to exclude trans women, meaning that I couldn't have a lesbian-only event because we'd have to include those men with certificates. And by the way, you're not allowed to ask these men to show that they have a certificate, because that is a human rights violation. So you have to let any Tom, Dick and Harry in. So in terms of the Ladies' Pond, we have women-only spaces, female-only spaces for a reason. We have them because of the sexual harassment, the threat of sexual harassment, the threat of sexual assault, the way that some men make women feel uncomfortable. When we set up those spaces and when the law came in tandem with our demands, it wasn't because we were saying all men are potential rapists or all men sexually harass. We said a sizable minority may pose a risk. And because of that minority, we have the right to protect female-only spaces. Nobody said, well, you mustn't do that because you're saying all men are going to attack women. But as soon as we do that and say that we want to exclude the sort that identify as women, we get accused of saying that all trans-identified men are rapists.
And Zoe, one of the kind of stranger bits in the piece was when you spoke to Kate and Zara, and they said what I think everyone would be thinking, which is, why can't they just use the mixed pond?
Yeah. I mean, these two girls, it was great because I thought, well, I'll speak to these, you know, they're young. They're probably going to be really pro-trans in the pond. And they were very thoughtful, and they began being quite cautious, and they said this is a really dangerous area for people of our age to comment on because we get in so much trouble if we say the wrong thing. but we are sportswomen and, you know, we can't, we really are passionately against all this in sports. It's less of a big deal here, but, you know, this, and then they posed this kind of genius question and it was like, yeah, that's literally sums it up. And I think that is the thing about why, you know, again, it goes back to the sort of, why is it always put upon, things are always put upon women. So the men aren't being put upon by this. The mixed pond wouldn't be put upon by this. No, no, no. And it's no coincidence. And then, you know, the rabbi I spoke to actually also said, look, there's a reason they're here. And they police the trans women are policing the ladies pond Facebook page also. And in their view, it's plainly about being domination. And so, you know, there is that underpinning it. However friendly and lovely many, and if not most, I don't know, trans women are. I just want to also say, and forgive me if I'm jumping ahead, I think there's something so fascinating about the way this debate takes shape now, because it is obviously partly generational, but obviously these ladies I spoke to, the young ones, show that it's not as neat a cut as one might think. But, you know, the ladies' pond, one of the reasons I love it is because, I mean, I've studied quite a bit of the history of the women's liberation movement, and I'm familiar with some of the figures in the British movement from the 70s who are, you know, now historians and academics or whatever. And a lot of them go to the pond. And these are these battle axes from the 1970s movement who were considered like loony left, you know, over like the equivalent of, sort of the equivalent of the Gen Zs of today, but actually with intellectual meat behind them. Anyway, they all frequent it now. And, you know, I see all sorts of people there that I now know, but recognize from Spare Rib or reading stuff, you know, my postdocs or PhD or whatever. And they are like now suddenly finding themselves completely disenfranchised from this kind of new sinister stranglehold that the City of London is embracing, and it is obviously led largely by the younger contingent of women. So you get this thing where you get these absolute architects of the most, you know, of feminism being kind of made to feel uncomfortable and spoken to incredibly rudely at the protest last year, just shouted at, told to educate themselves. I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, this is an old thing. We know that TERFs tend to be the old guard and the ones who are incredibly rude and disrespectful to them are the young guard. But it's still very stark when you see these titans of feminism being told to get in their lane.
I think that's a really good point, because the reason why this is seen as so generational, it's not because there's something specific, I would argue, about older women. In other words, you know, we have no idea, we have no clue as to the modern society. It's actually because we fought for and won those rights. So we were the ones that set up women-only spaces. We were the ones that demanded rape crisis provision for women that wasn't about going to a male doctor. It was about seeing a feminist counsellor and support network and having that time away from men. We were the ones that set up the domestic violence refuges because men were such a danger when women left. And we've seen this old misogyny over the decades. I was involved in the women's movement from right at the beginning of the 1980s. And I have seen this rabid men's rights movement, which is what trans activism is. That's all it is. And it always takes the same shape. Men going along to women-only spaces, demanding that they're let in, demanding to know why we're saying that men are all rapists, demanding to know why we can't accept that they too are victims of domestic violence, all of that. But the problem is that at that time, when these rabid men's rights activists were attacking our women-only spaces, the liberal masses and our institutions didn't all get on board with the wrong side. They could see them for what they were. But with this gender identity nonsense, and you referred to it as a debate earlier, Zoe, and I would say it hasn't been a debate. We have been silenced. Stonewall imposed a no debate, which is over now. It's great. It's over because we've made it so that we have to speak and people have to hear our voices. But during this whole time of gender identity, people have been swept along by the notion that these men who claim to be women are oppressed by us. By left-wing feminists, many of whom are lesbians. It's the most incredible Orwellian twist, and it was very clever for a time, but it's over.
Zoe, I just want to finish by asking you to make a prediction. Do you think the City of London Corporation will eventually adjust the guidelines that they brought in 2019?
Possibly not. I think they're captured. I think they'll just stay hedging and it'll just rumble on. And eventually the old guard will just get pummeled into submission and everyone will just kind of, it'll just keep happening. But, you know, vogues change. And I think, you know, you'd be quite the trans person to now still think you're welcome, frankly, even though these, you know, you may be welcome, but you might, this might be the ideal summer to think maybe I'll go to the mixed pond and give these ladies some peace. But I don't know. We'll see. One does see the odd trans woman. Just I wanted to also finish with one point, which is like, you can boil it down, much like the question, why don't they use the mixed? The question, are you happy to see penises in the showers? The pro, very, very pro trans, willing to really protest and fight for it. Lesbians that I spoke to, it was very lesbian this time. At the pond, it is in the summer. I said, look, okay, that's all very well. Yes, the penis. They said that line about the penis isn't dangerous. It's the person behind it, etc. The old line. And I said, okay, how would you feel? Do you feel completely fine, you know, showering with a person with a penis in the shower? They had to admit, it's not ideal. So I think if you boil it down to the brass tacks of that, then that does. I mean, I personally, and many women feel, if a trans woman's had all the surgery, and you know, then it feels a bit less, you know, because they've really gone the distance there. But the penis is no peens in our pond. I stand by that slogan.
Well, even in the men's pond, they have now put up a sign saying you can't sunbathe naked. So even the men don't want to see penises either, which I concur with.
Well, some of them do. Some of them do.
Well, yeah, okay, some of them do. Julie and Zoe, thank you very much.
That's everything this week. As ever, if you've enjoyed these discussions, you can pick up a copy of the magazine and read all the articles in full. And if you do enjoy the podcast, please do click the follow button to be notified when a new episode is out. I'm Laura Prendergast.
And I'm Gus Carter. And we hope you join us again next week.